This is the first in a series of lectures relative to the human-animal bond. I guess he's taping me now. He ran out. I assume everything's all right. Today is an overview so that having heard today, you won't be totally bereft of knowledge of the human-animal bond. Each of my lectures will be self-contained so that hopefully you gain something from them. It is essentially a slide presentation, and that's why we're here in this room and had to move it. I failed to let the management know that it was principally slides. So as soon as these people are seated, I'll turn off the lights and we'll go with this. A lot of people ask where I'm from, and I'm from Pullman. Pullman, Washington is the home of Washington State University. They often say of Pullman what they say of Perth, Australia. It isn't the end of the world, but you can see it from there. And this is, you can see uptown Pullman from there. Downtown looks about the same. This big mailbox here belongs to the College of Veterinary Medicine, where I have been dean for the last 10 years and have just recently stepped down as of September 1. It's a tough job. My replacement on his second day went into Sacred Heart Hospital for a brain tumor operation. So it's a challenging job. During my lifetime, I have been involved initially during the morning of my life in a great revolution. And it was the revolution that occurred in the world as a result of the splitting of the atom. I was involved in part of this. My work took me from the grandstand into the playing field for part of it. It was an exciting time to live. The impact of this revolution has changed history in more ways than you can probably imagine. In my own field of biomedicine, the advancement made in biology and medicine as a result of this discovery, in my scientific career, more developments were made than in all of the history prior to this time. This is no mean or common thing. And I thought this revolution was enough for one person's lifetime. Now, in the evening of my career and of my life, I am involved in three other revolutions will have a significant impact, certainly on my field and also on you. And the first one is the computer and other high-tech developments. This has changed our life, but that is not what I wish to discuss today. I will discuss some of it as its impact on the human-animal bond later. The other revolution has to do with monoclonal antibodies and genetic engineering. You have not seen very much of this yet, unless you are actively involved in the research relating to it. In our particular college, we are involved in some facets of it and are on the cutting edge of some of it. And this will change how we do things in a remarkable way. One of our great concerns is to profile dairy cattle to determine if there are certain markers for resistance to disease. And then we will develop disease-resistant strains of animals. This could have a great impact on other areas of involvement. But that isn't what I'm going to talk about either. I'm going to talk about the third revolution that has concerned me very much in the last 10 years. And it has to do with animal well-being and the human-animal bond. My premises initially are that a lonely dilemma descends upon us when we are separated from the elemental processes of nature, for we are parts of a stupendous whole. And to the extent that we as a people are separated from animals, we are the poorer for it. For this is what I call the eternal triangle. We are related as people to animals and to plants. And there are bonds between these. There are relationships which, to our peril, are fractured. Or if they're fractured, it is to our peril. And the human-animal bond, that's a strong word. It is the interrelationships between animal and people, and that is, in most cases, stronger than that having to do with plants. And by bond, I mean a very strong word, such as mother-child bond, or husband-wife bond, the marriage bond. When one member of the bond will give its life for another, that is a very strong bond. And here you see the dog licking my wife's hand. There is an old French saying that the tongue of the dog is good medicine. So I'll start with my own family. Some of you have now recognized my wife, Signa, who I call the chief. When we were at the University of California many years ago, she complained a lot about me being gone so much. So we got this dog, and we had to think up a name for this dog, and I said, well, we'll call it Great Reluctance, so that whenever I leave you, I can leave you with great reluctance. So that's Great Reluctance. And we live in an age today where animals are portrayed on television as really great, and people are generally some subservient or inferior creature. Even the rabbits on television are smarter than people. The caption on this: my wife drives a rabbit. It's a Volkswagen rabbit. And the caption on this is that Great Reluctance, although he's 16 years old, still loves to chase cars. Now, the Great Reluctance, as all of us, the ultimate statistic always catches up with us, that is, one out of one dies. But the animals have an advantage over us, that when they no longer enjoy life and have no chance of enjoying life, we can put them down, as we say. And that's what we did with Great Reluctance. And then my wife went through a period of grief. And one day I said to her, and she was familiar with this dog, which I call Dingbat, and which she doesn't like. She calls it Bridget, and most everybody else calls her Bridget. You've already been introduced to her. She's a certified hearing dog. It was fortunate that I did convince her that she should have another dog. And I told her that if she didn't like it, that we'd take it away after 10 days or 2 weeks. And with Bridget, I knew that she'd be hooked on her by a week, which she was. And it turned out to be most fortunate, because just before Easter, 2.5 years ago, I came home and my wife could no longer hear me. A hearing handicap or deafness is a very, very terrible thing. And it's a terrible disability because it separates you from people. I had worked with hearing handicap before this, but I didn't realize how bad it was till I had to live with it. And I said to my wife, well, we'll get you a hearing dog, because there are hearing dog training centers now that have similar status to guide dog training, not as rigorous. And she said, no, I don't want another dog now. I said, well, can you spare your dog to be trained for a couple of months And she says, no, I couldn't stand that. And I am very brash, and I said, well, we'll train Dingbat to be a hearing dog. Well, that was a long shot. And I started to train her for answering the door. And one of our associates in our activities at Pullman and Moscow at the University of Idaho and Washington State University community, we have an outstanding dog trainer named Terry Ryan. And she knew my wife because my wife had gone through obedience school with her Bridget. It's the people that go to obedience school, if you didn't know. And she had become quite obedient, at least to the dog. And so Terry had never trained a hearing dog, but was very interested in it and had heard me speak of it since I had been involved in it. And had been involved in initiating a program in England and involved in the follow-up of some of the animals in this country. So we began training her, and it's gone on for almost a year, I guess. And it was very difficult because here's an animal that is already now 5 years old, had a very bad upbringing because the people had first had it had been had mistreated her, and we had taught her not to jump on people, and hearing dogs have to jump on people to get their attention. That is hearing handicapped. It's no use barking to a deaf person if they're really deaf. And we also had trained her not to be on the bed. Well, we had to train her to jump on the bed if my wife was in bed for the smoke alarm or the alarm clock. There's nothing that Dingbat likes better than to make that 8-foot jump from the foot of the bed when the alarm goes off. But this is new surroundings for her here, so it took her a little while to jump on the bed this morning. I'm sorry that the alarm clock makes so much noise. Probably woke up everybody in Chalet 1 at 6:25 this morning. I apologize for that. But that's the price you have to pay for living with a hearing handicapped person. So that's an introduction to it. And I want to take you to show you the importance of this. In the middle here you have Mrs. Christensen from Gig Harbor. She was the first recipient of a hearing dog trained, that was trained by the Humane Society in the American Humane Society in Colorado. And I was involved in the follow-up of Ranger here with Mrs. Christensen and with one of the persons involved with it, named Miss Ray. And we went there to see how the dog was doing. And it, of course, answered the door and then got Mrs. Christensen and brought her to the door. And then we had a very pleasant chat, and then we had Mrs. Christensen lay down on her bed. And then Miss Ray played her tape recorder to indicate that the smoke alarm was going off, and the dog took a big leap right on top of her, which has a way of getting you up. And she got up, and then she came running out in the living room and jumped on me. She was going to clear the house, you see. Or he was going to clear the house. And then we tried the telephone. Now, a lot of people say, well, why have a telephone for a hearing handicapped person? Well, for Mrs. Christensen, she can then answer the phone and say, I can't hear you, but if there's an important message for me, you call up this number where my daughter is, and she'll get the message to me. In the case of my wife, she has an amplified phone system, and she can hear simple things and can also give a message if she can't understand as to who can handle it. But in this case, there was a poor recording on the tape recorder, and the dog looked at the tape recorder, looked at the telephone, and then looked at us and said, who's pulling my leg? And then we asked her if there was any other problems, and she says, well, the dog doesn't wake me up when the alarm goes off. So we got her alarm clock and tried it out, and the bell had fallen off, and it was a buzzer. And the dog had been trained, you see, to a bell. And so we lent her another alarm clock, which had a bell on it. See, dogs can tell C-sharp from C-flat. And you better be aware of this. They can do far better than we can in a lot of things. I know it's hard for us to accept that. But the thing that I remember most about this visit was that when I left Mrs. Christensen, she saw us to the door. And she said, as important as it was, and it is, for me to have a hearing dog, it was even more important for me to have a companion. And that has stuck with me ever since. And I hope you too remember that. Some of you are familiar with guide dogs. That's been going underway for longer. And I'll never forget what Mrs. Riddle told me, Gail Riddle from Vancouver. She says this, she's a professional woman and also a mother. This is her third guide dog. And she says, that dog is not only my eyesight, but it's my freedom. And this animal, of course, is very important to her. Now, this human-animal bond that I've been talking about, and the bond is, of course, strongest with those who work with their dog the most and who live alone with them or with their animal. But it's not restricted to my family or to this country. This happens to be in Denmark. And the fellow, and the one that's the member of the family that's riding shotgun is wearing the goggles today. I thought it was a great picture. And this animal, to this person who lives alone, is probably the most important thing in his life. And I don't want you to remember, I don't want you to forget that either. And there's a lot of people like that. It is not restricted to Europe. It's also in Africa. And when I visited the Maasai in Africa some 5 years ago, they are carrying on like they have for many years. And their animals are not only their status symbol, their source of sustenance, probably also tied up with religion, but also a source of companionship and also play for the youngsters and perhaps the little goats also for the oldsters and the amusement of all of them. So this is something that's pervasive, that has gone on for a very long time. There is argument as to how long this has continued, but the bond between animals and people may be as old as 60,000 years. In the diggings, this is a scene from a report on one of the more recent findings in the Old Crow in the Yukon on some diggings there, where there was indication that this bond and the association of animals and people closely was traced to at least 28,000 years ago. The earlier data had indicated 10,000 to 12,000 years, because about 10,000 years ago, I imagine there are the indications, definite indications of domestication of livestock, but it could well have occurred before this. But they were certainly of importance to them. In some of the earliest paintings on caves are pictures of animals. And these are some of them. Often they are animals of utilitarian purpose. That is, for meat, they were objects of hunt. There is, however, indications by some people, and it's described partially by a good friend of mine named Bruce Fogel, who has just released this book called Pets and Their People. He has dedicated the book to me, so I'm somewhat prejudiced for it, but you don't have to read the dedication. But in this book, and he's a very prominent veterinarian in England, he takes care of animals along Downing Street, among other things. But he makes a case in there that companionship probably also occurred very early. Certainly, animals have been involved in religion. I will talk probably at another time during the next week about the Judeo-Christian ethic and the animal bond. It is very much misunderstood. But the lamb figured very heavily into Judeo-Christian religion, and of course in other religions too. Be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the fowl of the air and over every living thing that moveth upon the earth. This is a very misunderstood thing. Many people have taken advantage of this and said, we're in control and we'll take care of them the way we wish to take care of them. And this isn't really the way it is if you read the Bible in total. Probably more correctly, we should caress lovingly, not subdue our associates on this earth. Behold, I establish my covenant with you and your descendants after you and every living creature that is with you. In other words, the covenant was not only with people, but with all creatures. And that's another thing I don't want you to forget. The dove is also very important in Judeo-Christian ethic. In other religions, such as Zeus, the god Zeus, was a bull. And if you look in the South Pacific culture, there were other animals that were worshipped. Pigs in some cultures, non-human primates in others. Dogs were important in many cultures. Certainly they were in Egypt. They were made over much during before Christ in Egypt. And they were regarded as very dependable creatures. In fact, the star Sirius, and I won't point it out to you, but just to remind me to tell you, that the star Sirius is called the dog star. It was the most faithful star, and it was the star that they looked for in the sky that was the signal for them to move from lower ground to higher ground before the Nile flooded every year. And they called it the dog star because it was so dependable. When it appeared, they had to move to high ground, and if they moved to high ground when it appeared, they were always safe from the flood. So they respected the dog immensely. But they worshipped the cat. They made much over the cat. And it isn't only then, but also now. I remember now we decided last fall we couldn't afford both a distemper shot for the dog and a flu shot for you. And that's how we are in this culture, whether it's dog or cat. I know many people, if the mother-in-law is sick and the dog is sick and there are limited finances, I'll tell you who gets the medical treatment. Or if it's the child, they said, well, that's the same thing as it had 6 weeks ago or 6 months ago. But if the dog is sick or the cat's sick, they usually go off to the veterinarian. I'm not defending that. I'm just telling you this is the way it is in many places today in our culture. The cats, for example, have gilt-edged bowls and mink collars, and I'm not defending that either. But people make much over it. They also train their cats to use the potty. This is Spook, who belongs to one of my associates, and she's trained to use the potty chair. You can get kits to do this now. But I caution you, if you're going this route, that you don't teach them how to flush, because they just love to flush, and they'll keep flushing, and it's hard on your water bill, unless you put in a timer so that it won't flush more than every so many minutes. So that's Spook. But in ancient times, Mark Twain said that if humanity could be crossed with a domestic cat, it would improve us, but it would diminish the cat. So that's the view of a lot of people. And this association, in fact, I should tell you before I talk about this, in ancient Egypt, it was the downfall of one of the large cities in Memphis in about 5 B.C., when one of the Persian kings was invading Egypt. But in Egypt at that time, the cat was worshipped. In fact, if you killed a cat, it was worth your life. And if a cat died, those nearest to it had to shave their heads and their eyebrows and go into about 6 weeks of mourning. In some diggings in Egypt, quite a few years ago by the British, they found 80,000 mummified cats that had been mummified by the most modern means at that time. And in every container, there was a mummified mouse for the cat to take care of it in its afterlife. So that's how they regarded the cat in that time. Now, this invading Persian king found out about this, and he was having trouble. I think it was the city of Memphis. And his intelligence services told him that these people worshipped cats. So what he did was to collect up a whole bunch of cats and catapulted him into the city. And the residents were so shook up with this that they capitulated. They gave up because they couldn't stand to have their cats mistreated. This association of man and beast, I think, is a beautiful story here. It was described by Pliny the Elder a couple of thousand years ago. Some of you can correct me on when Pliny the Elder lived. But he described an association of the dolphins and the fishermen, which is portrayed here. And what happened on this was that the fishermen would set their nets, and then they would look for a shoal of mullet or other fish. And on seeing them, they would splash the water, which would be the signal for the dolphins to approach. And they would usually come in up to 10 abreast to move the fish into the nets. And then they would both share in the take. A lot of people didn't believe this. In fact, they didn't believe it till it was described again in the Mauritanian coast, I think in about 1500 to 1700. So that's an interesting association. I can give you a lot of examples of this. In the Indian culture, animals were very, very important, especially the coyote and the salmon, if you've read anything about Native Americans. And the line between people and animals is far less definite to the Native American than it is to us. In fact, you can sort of move from one to the other in their culture. I have described some of this history in a book in the library called Animals, Aging, and the Aged. And it tells about not only how animals can help old people and gives a history, the early history of the human-animal bond, but it also tells how animals have helped us to understand aging and things like nutrition and so forth. And now to go back into more modern history, that is since the birth of Christ, there was a book that came out in 1860 by Duvet, who described in graphic form some of the experiences in Geel, Belgium. Geel, Belgium is a very famous town, for in about 800 to 900, they decided that it was appropriate for them as a city to accept the mentally deficient, the mentally retarded, have them live with them. And that's continued to today. So if you go there, there'll be a lot of strange people running around town. And they have taken them into their homes. And this person describes in this book some of the association and the importance of animals to these people. And it may go back as early as 900 or 1,000. And they describe how some of these mentally retarded people had special gifts with animals and how important the animals were to them to maintain some stability in their life. And it was very therapeutic for them. This is a famous painting called The Insane Asylum. The painter was probably a patient there when he did the painting. But it's to remind me to tell you about the York Retreat in England. It was started by the Tuke brothers in 1792. They were very disturbed with insane asylums of that time. They were very terrible. They would lock people up. They would give them sparse rations. When they misbehaved because for aberrations that were not under their control, they would put them in chains. It was a very terrible situation. So they said, that's a terrible way to do it, so we will start the York Retreat, and we will dress the people up, we will feed them well, we will have training programs for them, and we will not put them in chains for aberrant behavior. And we will also include animals in the therapy. So these people had to take care of chickens, rabbits, and other animals. And they noted that it was very successful in their therapy. And this was continued, I believe, for a very long time. Even in my early childhood, or even into high school, there were farms associated with retirement homes, nursing homes, the so-called poor farm, in prisons, and in mental institutions. In fact, they had some good livestock there, which I, as a high school student, would go and judge their cattle. And I noted at that time the remarkable association and the great benefit to these people. Unfortunately, they have discontinued this in most places. They've done a cost-benefit analysis, and they knew how to figure cost but not benefit. This is the most picture of the most remarkable place that I've ever visited. It's in Bethel in Bielefeld, Germany. Bethel means city of God or house of God. And in 1867, Christians in Westphalia decided that attics and back rooms were not the appropriate place to keep the retarded and the epileptics. So they decided to set up Bethel, where the people, these such people, would come in and live with them as members of an extended community. This has been continued until today, when there are over 5,000 people who are disadvantaged and over 5,000 people who take care of them in some of the most remarkable facilities that you'll ever see on earth. It is called an institution without walls. There's a movie on this by the Latham Foundation, which I helped with in a small way, which depicts the importance of animals in this association. The front door is never closed, and it is truly a remarkable story. One of the great friends of Holden Village, Edna Hong, has written a bestseller on it called Bright Valley of Love. I recommend this book to you. And if you ever get the opportunity, you should visit this place. I'll probably have more to say about it during this next week. But the animals are very important to them. They have large farms. Here you see some of the patients feeding the waterfowl. They have a wild game park. They even have a stadium for horses now in more modern times. They have aviaries. They have dogs and cats and, of course, many domestic livestock, which are very important in their therapy. I was interested in a book that came out in 1850 by S. Butler. He said, I should prescribe for Mr. Pontifax a course of the larger mammals. Let him go to their house twice a week for a fortnight and stay with the hippopotamus, the rhinoceros, the elephants. I find that these beasts do my patients more good than any other. The larger mammals were both distracting and soothing, and with the elephants and the pig tribe generally, he should mix just now as freely as possible. And I was very happy to see this because I'm a great lover of pigs, and I'm going to have one of my favorite lectures is My Life with the Pigs. My family never shows up for this, but it's a fun lecture, and I'll have more to say about that later. And then the larger mammals did indeed help to restore the sanity of the young hero, and they even soothed his guardians, who felt that he was receiving an influx of new life or deriving new ways of looking at life by the process. And this was written in 1850. Now, what he has said there has been shown to be true in more recent times by the research that shows that something does happen physiologically to you as you observe animals and touch them. In more recent times, in my parents' native Norway, there is a place called Betestolen. It's up on the Valdres, north of Oslo. Here you see Erling Stordal, who is a blind musician, and his wife, Anna. And they have set up Betestolen, which is a sports plots, where disadvantaged people of all kinds can come. Physical therapy is very important, swimming, but also important to them are animals. Horseback riding is very important to them, and also with dogs. Probably it's more famous because you've heard of, that's a place where they teach blind people how to ski. It has been exceedingly successful. The Lions Club of Norway helped them a lot to collect funds. And as a blind musician, he is well known throughout Norway, and many people gave them funds. In fact, they got so many funds that they decided they should also export this to America. So they bought property, and I think now there had been established a place something like this near the Twin Cities. I told them that was a very good place to have this because there's a lot of Swedes there, and wherever you have Swedes, you have a lot of disadvantaged people. In America, if you go into older times, I should preface this by saying that the Indians recognized what the white man was doing to his or in her country. The bond was fractured between people and the environment, and especially the animals. And Chief Seattle wrote a letter to the president about 129 years ago. And it's a beautiful letter that I recommend to everyone, I'm only going to give you one paragraph from it. What is a man without beasts? If all the beasts were gone, men would die from great loneliness of spirit, for whatever happens to the beast also happens to man. All things are connected. Whatever befalls the earth befalls the sons of the earth. The only correction I would make, it also befalls the daughters of the earth. And it's something that we must pay attention to. But the fracture it has, this bond that existed so long in history, through thousands of years, in the last few hundred years, has been fractured, and this bond has also changed remarkably. The bond has become abnormal in many cases. The bonding has become exaggerated. To many people, they no longer have children, they have animals, so it's like a child. The industrialization probably has contributed greatly to this. More people living alone. In our modern history, this happens to be Dr. Boris Levinson and his dog Jingles. Boris Levinson is on the left. The better looking one is on the right. Boris is a clinical psychologist, but before I tell you that, I should tell you that really the first recorded use of animals in therapy in the United States was really by the cooperative endeavors of the U.S. Army Air Corps and the Red Cross, who before the end of World War II, established at the Pauling Hospital, Army Hospital, a farm situation as a therapy center for the victims of the war. It was highly successful, this association of the victims of the war, the patients there, and the animals. But again, they did a cost-benefit analysis. They knew how to figure costs, but not benefit, and so they discontinued it. Now, I think in the 50s, Boris Levinson, the clinical psychologist at Yeshiva University, was doing a lot of work. He always had a dog, but whenever he was expecting a patient, he always put his dog in the back room. He had a lot of referrer patients, especially children. And on this particular day, he was working on his records. He didn't expect his next patient for an hour and a half or two. But suddenly, the door of his office opened, and there was his patient and the patient's mother. Now, if you would have been the mother of this child, you would have come an hour and a half early too, because it had a very serious problem. And the dog immediately took up with the boy. The mother was filling out the forms, I suppose, and responding to the questions of Dr. Boris Levinson. And suddenly she realized that the dog was mixing it up with her boy. She was about to interfere, and Boris then stopped her from interfering, and he just let him go at it. And this really started him on a career of utilizing animals as therapy for people, especially children. And he wrote two books about it. They were mostly anecdotal information, but very useful. And he made a plea that we have more structured studies. I should say that Boris Levinson also was subject to a lot of criticism. When he would present a paper on his results of using animals in therapy, the people would make fun of him, and they'd ask him questions like, did you split your fee with the dog? Now, here is two of my other friends, Sam and Elizabeth Corson. They were working on a model in dogs of hyperkinetic children at a psychiatric hospital at Ohio State University. And the patients there heard the dogs barking. And they said, well, can't we have access to the dogs? Well, they were very busy, and they sort of put it off. But they're very sensitive people and decided, well, why not? So they went to the psychiatrist and made a deal with them. Of course, the psychiatrist, who would they give them? Well, you'd let them work with the patients that they hadn't had any success with at all, that were absolutely refractive to any therapy. I'll only tell you about one of these, and his name was Sonny. He was 19 years old, sacked out in his bed, hadn't responded to any kind of therapy, didn't communicate with them, just laid in his bed. And so they had good profiles on their dogs, and so they kind of matched up their dogs with the patients. And with Sonny, they gave him Arwin. Arwin is a wire-haired terrier, and he's probably like some of you. He's an aggressive lover. And so he took right off on old Sonny, probably went up and licked his face, started to play with him. And they sort of mixed it up there for a while, and then Arwin jumped off the bed and ran down the hall. And old Sonny jumped out of his bed and ran after him. It's the first time they'd seen him out of his sack for a long time. And in 6 weeks, Sonny was discharged. He would come back to the hospital on occasion to see the dog. And they were successful in almost all of their patients to have some modification that was beneficial to them. And they recorded it on television and made analysis of it. But they ran out of money, so they had to get rid of their dogs, and they advertised them. And there was a fellow at the Castle Nursing Home in Millersburg, Ohio, who responded to the ad, because he had noted as he went around his large complex with his dog how the people there responded to his animal. I had noted the same things when I took animals to nursing homes, like great reluctance. How the people didn't so much care about me, but they sure wanted to touch the dog. And he had noted this, so he took the animals in, and it remarkably changed many of the people there. I'll tell you about one of these, and his name is Jed. Jed had been there for at least 2 decades, and as far as most people knew, he didn't communicate with anyone. He was aphasic, that is, he didn't speak. He'd grunt now and then and maybe say a word. When Sam Corson brought him this dog, Jed said, "You bought that dog," which is probably more words than he'd said in a couple of decades. And he asked, "Can I keep the dog?" Shall I repeat some of this? Oh, okay. And so he says, "Can I keep the dog?" And certainly he could. And so he kept him till he died. And it changed his life remarkably, because one of the benefits of animals is that they socialize you. And it socialized him. He began drawing pictures of dogs, tracing them first, and then doing freehand drawings. And here you see a picture of one of his freehand drawings. Now, that isn't great art, but it's better than I can do. But it's something very significant about this. They're both laughing. And that's probably our best therapy today. And he had caught this. Now, a friend of mine who I work closely with in the Delta Society is a psychiatrist named Mike McCulloch. He's a prominent psychiatrist in Portland, Oregon, very large institute there. He was raised right as a psychiatrist because his older brother is a veterinarian, and he brought him up to understand the importance of animals. So he utilizes animals in his therapy. And he did a survey of a lot of people, and he found out that the animal did a lot of good things for him, which you can see here. Is that in focus? Okay. And you see that they had high marks, over 9 out of 10 said it was an important part of my life, stimulated me to be more physically active, an affection greatly appreciated of the animal, that it helped me cope with isolation and loneliness. It was a source of companionship during illness, made me feel needed, made me more secure with pet around, and distracted me from worry about problems. 8 or 9 out of 10 said this. The only thing, however, was 100% was that it made me laugh. And I think that's very important. For some of you who have read Norman Cousins' book, The Anatomy of Illness, you realize the importance of laughter. Now, here's a picture of Dr. No, it isn't yet. I wanted to tell you about this. The people who write fiction today, and the cartoonists, the artists, really have a sense of what's going on. This is a drawing I made on a slide at 39,000 feet. It's a dog with a floor lamp shade on it, okay? Now, this was a series in the New Yorker. I take the New Yorker magazine chiefly for the cartoons. And this was a cartoon series where it's the classical case. The man of the house comes home, sits down in his big chair, and the dog brings him first one slipper, and then his second slipper, and then he returns and brings him the paper. He opens up the paper to read it. But in the next scene, the dog appears wearing this floor lamp. And the man, of course, puts down his paper and laughs and slaps his thigh, you see? And then the dog disappears with the floor lamp, comes back and lays down alongside of him. You see, he caught the essence of this, the importance of animals in therapy with their institution of laughter. This is a picture of Mike McCulloch. And he has many animals. He's always gotten pets for his children. But more recently, he's gotten a child for his pets. This is his newest child. You see Molly on the right there, and the dog is on the left. One of the dogs is on the left. So I thought you'd appreciate this. And he's been highly successful. There's a movie, in fact, out by the Latham Foundation on a person that had dialysis of his kidney. And he and the whole family were going down the tubes. He was threatening suicide, and it was a terrible situation. So he put him on getting a dog. He ended up with a basset hound, and it changed the whole milieu of that family. And it's a beautiful movie. It was one of his patients. Now, there have been many centers now established in many parts of the world to take advantage of this. One of the leading ones in research is the University of Pennsylvania, where I have many friends. And here are two of them, Alan Beck on the right and Aaron Katcher, psychiatrist, on the left. Alan Beck is most famous in the world for instituting the poop and scoop law in New York City. Now that takes some doing. He's an ecologist who put that through. He's now in charge of the center at the University of Pennsylvania. This is an interesting picture because they did the historic work on what the effect is of a person watching a fish in a fish tank. And they have shown that if you watch fish in a fish tank, your blood pressure falls. And they're also studying them in dentist offices. And when I get to be dictator, every dentist office and every situation where there's controversy, there will be a fish tank with fish in it. That's just one of many things I'm going to do when I get to be dictator. They did some very historic work, which has really shook up everyone throughout the world. And what they did, Erica Friedman was a PhD student with Aaron Katcher. And what University of Pennsylvania personnel and University of Maryland personnel did, they did a profile on heart attack victims or people with serious angina pectoris. And they did a very long scientific profile on them, a very intense one. And somebody says, why don't you add one more question to this form? You ask the question, do you own a pet? Now, they didn't really like the idea because it didn't sound very scientific to them. But they did add it. And what they did then, did a follow-up on all these people. And they found out that at the end of the year, the only thing that made any difference of all the questions in this profile, the only thing that made any difference on survival was whether they had a pet or not. Almost a third of those that didn't have a pet were dead at the end of a year. While only 3 out of 53 that had a pet was dead. Now this, you don't have to go to MIT and get a PhD in statistics to understand that this is very significant. We're still scratching our head as to the reason. But we do know, and they have shown, and others have shown, that if one of you started talking to me or came up here to talk to me today, sitting here on the chair with me and I was interviewing you, your blood pressure would go up measurably. But if your favorite cat or dog came and you started to pet it, your blood pressure would fall and so would the animals. For a child that's familiar with a dog, it doesn't even have to touch it. The presence of a friendly dog in a room lowers its blood pressure. There are probably other things that happen which have not yet been defined. There was another interesting study by a friend of mine named Roger Mugford, who does animal behavioral modification in London and in Paris. That's quite a job he has. What he did was to go out in Yorkshire and got people that were living alone who were over 70 years of age. They were all visited, and they were all given a gift to cooperate with them in the study. They did a profile on them to find out just where are they now. And then gave one group, they divide them into three, and they gave one group budgies, budgerigars, which are Australian parrots. They gave another group begonias, a plant, a flowering plant. Another group, they didn't give them anything. They visited them all every month for 5 months. And then they did another profile on them. And they found out that budgies won hands down. It really changed them. Begonias were better than nothing. So the take-home lesson is give them begonias and budgies, I guess. And the reason I have this picture up here is that some of the people built remarkable playgrounds for their budgies. They all called them endearing names, and although the study finished in 5 months, they went out to see some of them after 18 months, and they still had their budgies, and they were very, very happy with them, and they had done much for them in socialization, and it took their mind off their problems. Another area where they have a center for this type of study is called SenShare at the University of Minnesota. Minnesota is very forward-looking. In fact, they have legislation that does permit animals in nursing homes. More recently, California has enacted such legislation. We're working on it nationally now to allow animals in nursing homes and also convalescent homes and also in government housing. But this is a very active program, and Minnesota has been among the leaders. Many years ago, they started in their Humane Society having pets for prescriptions. It didn't really take off. But more recently now, more physicians are writing prescriptions for pets. In fact, in Pullman, we just finished filling a prescription for an animal recently. And also, Minnesota was it was the first place that they did hearing dogs, and where they started a hearing dog program. This is my therapist here. It's a self-portrait. This is to introduce to you animal facilitated therapy. Well, with this kind of history, you realize that there is something to it. We call it social therapy with animals. I think that's the best description for it, although you'll see it as pet facilitated therapy or animal facilitated therapy or things like that. I'm having trouble with this button. And we started about 8 years ago in a class in the veterinary school, in the veterinary college at Washington State University. We had a supplemental course. And in it, we went over to Moscow, Idaho, 8 miles away, because it was easier to get animals in the nursing homes there. And we put in some cats. And we put in some kittens, really. And that's what happens is that the animals grow up, and some of them get pregnant and have kittens. And that's what happened in this home. And life there has never been the same since. In fact, it's changed remarkably for the better. We now have animals in most all of our nursing homes in that area. One of the animals we placed in 1975 is still there. It's called Geriatrics, and it is. And it was remarkably successful. And for various reasons, other than what I've named you, and I'm going to discuss our People Pet Partnership on another occasion, but I just want to give those of you who will not be here just a brief introduction into our People Pet Partnership program of Pullman and the Palouse. We call it the PPP program. And it is an exportable product. It has been emulated in quite a few places in various forms. It is known now throughout the world. First part of it is the public-private school partnership. We took a chapter out of the Catholic Church. You get them when they're young. And so we go into kindergarten through the sixth grade with a program of animals and their benefits and also responsible pet care. One of our problems today is irresponsible pet care. And so we're trying to correct that way and other ways too. Another program in it is a companion animal partnership, bringing animals in nursing homes, convalescent homes, hearing dog programs, and encouraging this and in developing this kind of a program. Because I recognized a long time ago that cancer and heart disease are not our most serious problems in Western civilization. It's loneliness. And many physicians also will tell you that. It's our worst disease today. And we feel that one of the great benefits for people who are lonely are companion animals. And we have shown that. Probably the most definitive work on placement so far published is the very careful work that we have done, my associates have done, on guidelines for animals in nursing homes. And it may be interest to some of you that we had our first test on this. Well, we did a lot of tests on it, but officially our first one was at the Tacoma Lutheran Home, which is one of the most modern and best facilities of this type probably in the Northwest, if not in the nation. And they are, in fact, I think, hiring a half-time animal therapist. And we did a 2.5-day study there. Social worker, nurse, and educator, and a veterinarian, and working with the management, and also with the staff, and also with the residents, and then outlined a program for them, which was very interesting. This is we're already sold out of these. The California Veterinarian published it. And then we started the prison partnership, which is a very exciting program, which I won't have time to tell you about. We're into the Purdy prison, which is a maximum security prison for women, and we're having them train animals to help the handicapped. It's had a fantastic change on the people that do it, and also on the people that get the animals. We put them in communication, and it's changed their lives. You see, the dogs, they train these dogs to help disabled, and the dogs don't know the record of the prisoners. And the partnership in equine therapy and education, I guess we have about the only one associated with the university. It's struggling, but it's been highly successful to help people such as this. When you've been sitting in a wheelchair all your life looking up and you're suddenly vaulted on a horse and go places where you've never been looking down on people, it has a fantastic effect on you. It also has a great physiological effect. Some miracles have occurred as a result of this. The original organization for looking at all this was SCAT, was really called the Group for the Study of Human-Animal Bonds, started in England. Now it's called the Society for Companion Animal Studies. The comparable organization in this country is called the Delta Society. It was started, it'll be 2 years old this October, and it is a North American version of this same organization. I'm the president of it, and here is the more important person, my associate of many years, who is now the executive director. We've just set up offices this month in Renton, Washington, for North America, and she's the permanent first executive director, a lady with unusual skills. She also serves in Holden on the scientific committee. She's an educator by training and a master organizer. And we have had several international congresses, and this is to remind me to tell you about the next one, which is in October in Vienna. And this happens to be Conrad Lorenz with his geese. And that's another story. Here's another picture of him. This Congress is in his honor. We're celebrating his 80th birthday. And I am the one to give the accolades for him for the Western world, the English-speaking countries. He became famous with his field work in ethology, that is, in animal behavior. He records some of this in his book called King Solomon's Ring. Fantastic book, which you'll enjoy very much. And he also shared the Nobel Prize for his work. And so this is going to be a fun time for us. One of my great concerns is what has happened to us and to our civilization. Everything is now a throwaway society. Even people have become throwaways. I'm, of course, concerned because of my profession with the animals as a veterinarian. I am very concerned about the animals, that they're not misused even in this type of therapy. But they have become throwaway items. And that's why I'm one of the reasons that I have left the so-called hard sciences that I've spent most of my life in, to go on a real crusade to do something about this. Well, and I've done many things. Among them is to start a course in reverence for life. And I've taught it now for 3 years. And the students in their evaluation this last year, I usually restrict it to 10 or 15 people. And it has been, I've had a remarkable response to it. The unanimous opinion of the class this year was that it should be a required course for everybody at the university. And they were out recruiting new students. And part of it is a Schweitzerian kind of a thrust. What I want our students to have when they leave us is not only capable hands to take care of animals, but that they have gentle words and caring hearts to address the needs not only of animals but of people. Some of you probably don't realize this, but And many people will never see a psychiatrist where they could benefit measurably by it. Many of them, however, feel safe in going to their veterinarian with their animal. And many times, there's really nothing wrong with their animal. But they have big problems. And sometimes, we can be helpful. And I want them to be trained so they can be helpful. One of my fellow professors when I was at the University of California system was the late Eric Hofer. He was never in formal education, but he was probably one of the best read people in the world. He wrote short books because he had the understanding of a meaning of a crisp sentence. Not long ago, he, in one of his final writings, he stated that as things are now, it may well be that the survival of the species will depend upon our ability to foster a boundless capacity for compassion. Matthew Fox wrote a whole book about it, and he said it's probably our last great hope.